This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in soon-to-be stormy downtown Madison. Democratic Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers says he may be forced to take Republican state lawmakers to court if they don't free up money meant to clean up PFAS chemicals around the state. Evers and Republicans initially agreed on setting aside $125 million in the current state budget to address contamination from the harmful so-called forever chemicals. But they have been at a stalemate for months over how exactly this money should be spent. Last week, Evers vetoed a Republican plan to provide grants to communities and landowners for cleanup. He argued the approach also made it hard for state regulators to hold polluters accountable. Today, Republicans who control the legislature's budget committee snubbed the governor after he called them for them to meet and release the money. Only Evers and Democrats showed up to the committee room, the Associated Press reports. Evers told reporters he would not rule out filing a challenge with the Wisconsin Supreme Court to force the issue.
Wisconsin's biggest electric utility company is asking state regulators to approve rate hikes for the next 2 years. WEC Energy Group owns We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service, which together provide power to more than half the state's ratepayers. Last Friday, the company filed paperwork with the State Public Service Commission to increase rates by a total of about $800 million through 2026, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. An average We Energies customer would see their monthly bills go up around $10 to $12 in 2025 and $7 to $8 in 2026, according to company estimates. Hikes for WPS customers would be slightly less. WEC says the hikes are needed to cover recent investments in renewable energy infrastructure, which will eventually save ratepayers money, but consumer advocacy groups point out that the utilities rates have already increased in recent years and are urging regulators to limit future hikes. The Public Service Commission will hold public hearings on the proposal and could make a decision later this year.
A group of Wisconsin voters with disabilities has brought a lawsuit against the state seeking the ability to vote electronically, the Associated Press reports. The case filed today in Dane County says requiring people with disabilities to use paper ballots is discriminatory and an unconstitutional barrier to voting because many can't use them on their own. Wisconsin already allows electronic absentee voting for military and overseas voters. The lawsuit seeks to expand that right to disabled voters before the state's August primary and November general election. It's the latest in a slew of legal proceedings over voting rules in the state, which has seen multiple razor-thin margins in recent statewide elections.
Milwaukee Public Schools is cutting 4 full-time trauma support specialist positions in one of the district's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. The roles were part of an initiative in the 53206 zip code to provide support services to students in an area affected by high levels of poverty, incarceration, and violence. But the support specialists were notified earlier this month that their positions were being eliminated due to funding issues, Wisconsin Public Radio reports. The employees were told they could apply for other jobs in the district. The move came just days after Milwaukee voters approved a $252 million school funding referendum, but a district representative said MPS had to make, quote, difficult decisions about their budget despite the referendum vote.
No, Exact Sciences does not have your UPS package. The Madison biotech company is trying to get that message out to area residents after a UPS tracking system error over the weekend mistakenly showed hundreds of people's orders had been delivered to Exact Sciences' West Side headquarters. The orders were actually still en route to their intended recipients, according to the Wisconsin State Journal, but the glitch led customers to call up Exact Sciences, or at least in a few cases, come knocking on its door. The company estimated about 1,000 orders were affected. A UPS spokesperson told the paper they were aware of the issue and that the packages had already been delivered or would be by today or tomorrow.
Wisconsin stargazers will get a chance to see one of the planet's oldest known meteor showers starting to appear this week. The Lyrids showers should be active from now to the end of April and will peak between April 21st and April 22nd, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports. The Lyrids are visible across the globe but are more intense in the northern hemisphere, including Wisconsin. Spectators could see as many as 100 shooting stars per hour at the shower's height, according to NASA. Now here's hoping the clouds cooperate. Those were the headlines, and now on to tonight's top stories.
Yesterday, more than 100 educators who work in public schools around the city gathered outside the Doyle Administration Building, headquarters for the Madison Metropolitan School District. They were there to demand better pay and more resources as the district's budget cycle kicks into high gear. WORT reporter Charlie Belaski and news producer Faye Parks were there.
That was the sound of more than 100 teachers gathered outside the Doyle Administration Building yesterday evening. Inside, the Madison School Board met to work on a slate of policy items, including their budget for the next school year. Outside, protesters demanded better pay and more resources for educators. That's after the district proposed no raise for Madison teachers as an opening negotiation gambit, pointing to a projected $12.5 million budget shortfall on the horizon. But the school district could offer up to 4.12% this year under a state law that only allows teachers' unions to negotiate raises up to the cost of inflation. Elva Tyson, a first-grade bilingual educator at Stevens Elementary, says they've heard this story before.
I'm here because I am frustrated that every year we have to battle for the basic respect of receiving a cost of living adjustment. Every year, more is tacked on to what we have to do, and yet the district disrespects us as professionals by coming to the bargaining with a 0% cost of living adjustment as their first offer, whereas the only thing we can really negotiate for is what work has set, and this year the standard is 4.12% to just keep up with inflation. When the district comes back at us with a 0%, and then they have the audacity to ask if we feel respected as professionals, the answer is a resounding no.
A district spokesperson tells the Capital Times that they propose no increase in wages, knowing that negotiations will evolve over the next few weeks. Andy Norderhow is an English teacher who's been teaching in Madison schools for 16 years. He says that Madison teachers can no longer afford to live where they work because of inflation.
And without the cost of living arrangements and everything higher for gasoline and groceries, you have a lot of people who can't afford to live in the community that we're servicing.
While some Madison teachers are commuting to work, others are leaving the district entirely. That's according to Jeff Knight, the executive director of Madison Teachers, Inc., the local teachers union. While MMSD has proposed stagnant wages for next year, other districts in Dane County are offering this year's maximum cost of living adjustment.
And they're actively recruiting teachers from Madison because of that.
And Knight says that high turnover during the school year means that teachers are saddled with even more work than usual.
And that makes their job more stressful. They have less time during the day to do the other kind of work they need to do as a teacher, emailing parents, grading papers, helping students, those kinds of things. So they're really burning people out a lot faster.
Cindy Ballard, a special education assistant at Muir Elementary, says that MMSD needs to prioritize staff during this budget process.
Because new swimming pools and all sorts of other things that need to happen to buildings, some of those things need to happen. Some of them are just really sexy and sound good, and you know. But if you don't have staff to fill those schools and support those students, then those kids aren't learning and maybe they don't even get to come to school.
Norderhow says that moving forward, he wants teachers to have a seat at the table.
There has been no communication, and we need to have a good working relationship. And if they have a reason why it's zero, tell us that, and then what's the plan for coming up better? If not, let's actively have a negotiation at a bargaining table like our collective bargaining agreement allows for.
The budget process is ongoing, but MMSD is expected to have the final draft in June. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
A private event this weekend at Brittingham Park left the area filled with trash, but community members have come up to clean where they can. WRT reporter Lila Grubb shares how you too can help clean up local parks as Earth Day approaches.
There's so many microplastics being washed into the shore, and I can only really imagine like what's in the lake if this is what's on the shore.
That's Isaac Evans, a junior at Madison West High School and member of the school's environmental club. Evans and three of his fellow clubmates left the classroom earlier this morning to pick up trash along the Monona Bay shoreline. That's after the park was left strewn with cans, bottles, and other trash on Sunday night, sparking online uproar on the Madison subreddit. Since then, Madison West's Environmental Club has done their part to help clean up the mess. Madison West Jr., Yishai Blum, had this to say about the club's role in keeping Brittingham clean.
It's like Brittingham Park have a lot of trash, and we have to come back here quite repeatedly to get as much of it as we can.
Brittingham Park neighbor Nina Emerson runs a volunteer group through the city's parks division. They meet on the second Saturday of the month to clean up trash in Brittingham Park and along the Monona Bay shoreline. Her group had just cleaned up the park last Saturday.
We had all these volunteers. We picked up all this trash all along Brittingham Park. And then to see people use the park with disregard is very disheartening.
Emerson says it's easy to get involved in the next cleanup.
All you have to do is show up at the Brittingham Beach House, and you show up there at 10 a.m. on the second Saturday of the month, and anybody can volunteer. We provide the supplies.
This Saturday is also the city's annual Earth Day Challenge, when from 10 a.m. to noon, you can help clean up the more than 60 parks across Madison. The Madison Parks Division says it's looking for 900 volunteers throughout the city to assist with trash pickup, raking, weeding, and more. As for Madison West students, the Environmental Club is also seeking members. Students interested in joining the club may contact West advisor Alana Torres for more information.
We've been looking for a lot more younger people to join, and joining will get you a lot of volunteer hours. Plus, it's also just nice to give back to the community.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Lila Grubb.
Conservative lobbyists and state Republican lawmakers are looking to drudge up how the city of Madison spent part of its pandemic-era federal funding. At issue is a $700,000 grant that State Senator Dewey Strobel, a Republican from Cedarburg, calls, quote, yet another example of waste and abuse of COVID dollars, unquote. But how was that money actually spent? WORT News producer Faye Parks checked in with one of the grant recipients.
The Institute for Reforming Government is a conservative interest group. They're slamming the city of Madison for how it allocated a fraction of aid it received as federal pandemic relief. Overall, the city received over $47 million from ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act. For Republicans, at issue now is a sliver of that aid, $700,000, that went to supporting undocumented immigrant residents in the city. According to a 2022 blog post from Mayor Rhodes Conway, that funding was carved out because undocumented immigrants face barriers that make them ineligible for, or limit their access to, other public benefits. For those families, the pandemic was compounded by missing out on aid most others received. That $700,000 grant was split between 8 local organizations, all of which aid undocumented immigrants in various ways. Those local orgs include the African Center for Community Development, the Catholic Multicultural Center, Centro Hispano, the Community Immigration Law Center, the Latino Academy, the Rainbow Project, and the Vericourt Neighborhood Center. A part of that funding also went to Rise Wisconsin, a local nonprofit organization that provides early childhood and mental health services to Dane County residents. For more on what that funding actually went to, I spoke with Fernando Cano Ospina, DEI director at Rise. Thank you for joining me, Fernando.
Thank you for having me.
So, very broadly, what kind of services does Rise Wisconsin provide?
We provide early childhood and mental health services from 0 to young adulthood. We also have emergency childcare services in our respite program. And we also provide corridor evaluations from Dane County and other counties around Dane County.
And so I understand that RISE received some federal pandemic relief funding from the city in 2022 for your work supporting undocumented immigrants. How much money did you receive and how was it spent?
We received $50,000 as part of a grant program that the city of Madison did with multiple organizations. We provided support to multiple families in our programs. We provided support with, food, support with access to transportation. We provide support with legal advice. So we were able to help hundreds of families in our programs. Many of these families are essential workers. They work every single day. They worked through the pandemic. They were not able to receive any support during those very heavy years of the pandemic, even though they were, working in the grocery stores, working in the factories, working in in the fields to provide the food and support for all of us. And the city was able to create this grant, and we were able to apply and provide, you know, essential support for them so they can continue to support their families, which many of their kids are documented or are citizens that are born here and also, you know, need the support to be able to grow into beautiful citizens of this country.
So you mentioned that there are barriers to receiving financial support for undocumented workers. Can you sort of walk us through how that works, why their barriers are there?
So during the pandemic, I don't know if you remember, many of us who are citizens and documented individuals were able to receive, you know, federal support, you know, the $1,000 check that or $1,200 check that many of us received during the high crisis of the pandemic. Undocumented individuals were not able to receive that, even though they were facing, you know, the bigger challenges in the pandemic. They were, you know, our essential workers. Many of them, you know, risked their lives to be able to help us, you know, continue production of food, continue, you know, the services that we had in our communities, but they were not able to get those funds, as many of us did. So when the city of Madison, you know, decided to do this grant, we realized that we had in our programs multiple families that, you know, had struggled during the pandemic, had struggled with, you know, not being able to get some of that support and, you know, being able to help them and help their kids so they can continue to be, you know, members of our community and continue to support was an awesome program.
So I understand this was a one-time grant. Is that accurate?
That is correct. That was a one-time grant. It was specifically designed to be able to help families, you know, with food, families with needs for the house, clothes for their kids. They had a restriction where we could not help them with housing assistance or to pay for rent, which is a huge need across the state and across Madison and Dane County. But we were not able to use these funds for that. We were able to use the funds to, you know, help with transportation. We were also able to help some individuals who are able to pay for attorney's fees to be able to become documented, to be able to ask for asylum, to be able to, you know, step out of the shadows. And that has not only a support now, but that has a huge, you know, impact on what they're able to do for themselves and for their families and their future. So it was very nice to be able to support them with that, you know, some of those big goals and also, you know, just food or gas or help with transportation, things like that.
In general, how much did each of them receive, and was it over a period of time or just a lump sum?
Yeah, it was over a period of time. Each family received different amounts, but in average, I think that we help around with $500 to $700 in average. Some families may have received, you know, $3,000 for groceries, depending on what their needs were. Some families received some help to pay for MG&E bill for, you know, $100. You know, all of the money was spent in the community, right? All of the money was spent here in Madison to pay for the things that they needed. So it kind of got reimbursed back into the community for the businesses in the community for, you know, for all of us to be able to receive the help that they needed.
And so a talking point that's come up a lot recently is the accusation that because the city allocated these funds to support undocumented immigrants, it was proof positive that the city did not need these funds. What are your thoughts?
Undocumented immigrants contribute to the community in ways that people don't know and will not be able to understand until they're in their shoes. Undocumented immigrants provide the food that many of us eat, provide the safety and resources. You know, we saw it in the pandemic, and I think it's important for everybody else to understand that, you know, the city needed the funds and that the funds were allocated correctly because these individuals need support. These individuals are parents of American citizens. These individuals are brothers and sisters of American citizens. And these individuals are American citizens, you know, young kids, young individuals that need our support. So, yeah, we are a country of immigrants. I myself have been a citizen for over 15 years, but I'm also an immigrant, and I understand what it means to be an immigrant. I haven't forgotten that. I love the United States. It has opened many doors for me. It is a beautiful country with beautiful people, and I think that when we do what we need to do to support everybody in our communities are better. When politicians are able to see everybody as human beings, needing support, needing protection, needing love, that's America. That's what we are. That's the best. That's the shining hill, right? So I think that, yes, the city did well. The city needed the support, of course, and the undocumented immigrants needed that support, deserve that support. And we need more programs like that, more funding like that.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Fernando.
Thank you so much.
That was Fernando Cano Ospina, the DEI director at RISE Wisconsin.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us. It's Tuesday, which means it's time for the Cardinal Call, a roundup of news coming out of the UW-Madison campus, produced by student journalists at the Daily Cardinal newspaper. This week, host Oliver Gerhartz talks with the Daily Cardinal's features editor, Ellie Bordeaux. In a recent article, she explored this year's Coming Together of People's Conference, which is held annually by UW-Madison's Indigenous Law Students Association.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your weekly dose of UW-Madison campus news from the Daily Cardinal student newspaper. I'm your host, Oliver Gerhartz. As of April 13th, the day that this episode is being recorded, the Indigenous Law Students Association, or ILSA, is hosting the 38th Annual Coming Together of People's Conference, where the group is informing members of the UW-Madison community about Indian law. Today we're joined by the Daily Cardinal's features editor, Ellie Bordeaux, to discuss the conference and the organization that leads it. Ellie, thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I want to first ask, what is the ILSA?
So the ILSA is the Indigenous Law Students Association. So it's an organization of Indigenous people, Indigenous law students, just students in general that are interested in Indian law or allies that all kind of get together and learn more about Indian law, share their resources, share their knowledge, all that kind of stuff.
So this is a pretty small group, right?
It's a pretty tight community. From what I've gathered from Steven Slack, who I talked to, he's the treasurer of ILSA, and he was kind of saying that it's a tight community, you know, because they're all interested in the same kind of things, and yeah.
Is this because of a sort of unique intersectionality that is sort of inherent to the organization that isn't present in a lot of other campus groups?
Yeah, I would say definitely. I think this is definitely something that they all share in common, and this is where they find community. Steven Slack especially, he told me, like, so he's a grad student at the law school, and he was saying that that's one of the first places that he felt home, you know, in this organization, because I think they all share a lot of similar interests and a lot of similar backgrounds and experiences. So I think this is a really close community for them.
One thing that I thought was interesting, and I think really speaks to that sort of tight-knit nature of that group, is that your source mentioned that they have a very responsive bench of alumni. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think it is kind of like I said before, because of the community they find there. I think because a lot of them have a lot of shared experiences and a lot of similar interests, especially with being interested in Indian law, I think that's something that when you are a part of that, I think it just kind of stays with you. I think that's why they have so many alumni and such a large bunch of it through the years.
So to get into more of a technical side, what is Indian law and why distinguish it from law?
So Indian law is, Stephen Slack kind of told me about it. He was saying that Indian law really refers to all the legislation that has to do with Indigenous peoples. So when there are tribes that they have their own laws within their tribe and within their land, like if you're traveling through a tribe's land, you are technically under their law and under their jurisdiction. But it also refers to the way that the government, the state government and the federal government interacts with these tribes and interacts with these Indigenous peoples and that kind of thing. So the laws that both Indigenous people create and the laws that the federal government creates or the state government to interact with those people.
So what happens at the Coming Together of People's Conference?
So at the conference, they have a lot of different events. So there's a lot of panelists that'll speak there all about Indian law and the importance of it and kind of just share their knowledge and their experiences with Indian law. It's for anyone that's interested in Indian law. It's open to the public. It's for anyone that wants to join. It's totally available to anyone. There will be panelists there, and then there are different social events. They have a drumming session and some other events available there. They have a film that they're showing at the end on Friday. I think they showed it. Yeah, so just a bunch of different ways to get more informed on Indian law and for anyone that's interested in it.
38 years is a pretty long history for an event. Well, what sort of impacts has the event had over that time?
You know, I think it's really informed a lot of people on the importance of Indian law and importance of recognizing the experience of Indigenous peoples. And I think this conference has been able to really help inform the community and anyone that's interested in Indian law, kind of fostering that interest and kind of letting them take that knowledge and run with it. I think that's why this has been so successful, because it's been so informative to a lot of people and to this community.
So how many people attend the conference, and sort of how far is the reach on it?
I am not sure how many people attend the conference, but it is open to all of the Madison community. It's open to any students, anyone that's interested in going. I'm not sure exactly how many people are usually there, but I think it has a pretty far reach just based on it being around for 38 years.
What are some of the issues being focused on at this year's conference?
Yeah, so some of the issues that they're going to focus on are ethics in Indian law, the research they have behind it, the publication of tribal nation codes and cases, and then a bunch of other things like tribal business codes, a discussion from the front lines of the Line 5 legal battle, and Indigenous higher education in Wisconsin, all that kind of stuff. So there's going to be a bunch of different topics, a lot to talk about.
I remember reading in your article that there is the issue of the Enbridge pipeline. Is that something going to be discussed at this?
I'm sure this is something that'll definitely be discussed. I think this is a really big issue in that community, and especially in Wisconsin with such a large community of Indigenous peoples. I think this is a really important topic, and I'm sure that there will be information on that.
So aside from the conference, what other kinds of stuff does ILSA do on campus?
Yeah, so they're involved in a lot of different things. They hold monthly meetings where they kind of talk about different issues going on in Indian law and that kind of thing. And when they are looking for new Indian law professors, they help interview these candidates and kind of get to know them a little more and give their input on what they think of the candidates, especially because they're going to be ones that are learning under them. I'm trying not to think. They have other events. They hosted a film not too long ago, or they screened a film not too long ago. I think at Union South. So yeah, they do a bunch of different stuff for the community and for students as well.
So is there anything else that you sort of learned over the course of your reporting that really stuck out to you?
You know, I think something that really stuck out to me is just how dedicated, especially Stephen, when he was talking to me, how dedicated he was to this group and especially to this event. It made me realize how important this is, and I think it's important for everyone to recognize that as well. And, you know, I think especially like I mentioned before, just because we in Wisconsin, there is such a large community of Indigenous peoples, and I think this is just a really great organization and a really great conference to really foster this community, and especially for anyone practicing Indian law or anyone interested in Indian law. So I think it's great.
Thanks for coming on this week, Ellie.
Yeah, thank you.
In other campus news, the Associated Students of Madison Sustainability Committee will be hosting events every Friday in the lead-up to Earth Day later this month. According to organizers, the events will lead up to a climate-focused march to the Capitol on April 20th. In other news, UW's UHS, or University Health Services, and Recreation and Wellbeing has announced a partnership with online mental health support platform Togetherall. The platform, which all UW-Madison students are now able to access for free, allows students to seek and provide mental health support while sharing their personal experiences. Also in the news, the university's Center for East Asian Studies held a symposium in Memorial Union on the 8th, commemorating the contributions of the university's 20th century Chinese students to the university and U.S.-China relations. The event highlighted the educational and professional experiences of three Chinese students and used their areas of study, which were economics, astronomy, and political activism, as a way to focus on the connection between China and the U.S. This has been The Cardinal Call, created by UW-Madison student journalists. Check out more news and stories at dailycardinal.com.
For 2 months each in spring, hundreds of Wisconsin birders crisscross the state, some roaming in teams, to try and record as many bird sightings as possible. But what motivates these birders? WORT reporter Catherine Garvins has their story.
It is May of 2023, and I'm gathering with others in the parking lot of Holy Wisdom Monastery in Middleton. I was invited here by Amy Alstead. She is the director of land management and environmental education at the monastery. She was good enough to let me tag along as she guided her co-workers through a birding tour of the grounds as part of the Great Wisconsin Birdathon.
The Natural Resource Foundation of Wisconsin hosts Birdathon. It's a fundraiser, so we're raising funds. When nonprofits like us host Birdathon, we get to keep 50% of the proceeds we raise. So 50% of it stays here, does bird conservation work right on our property, and 50% of it goes back to the Natural Resources Foundation. There are teams doing Birdathon all over the state of Wisconsin.
The Great Wisconsin Birdathon is the largest fundraiser for bird conservation in Wisconsin, with over $900,000 raised since its start in 2012. In the spring of 2023, more than 500 people from across the state participated in the initiative, which funded 11 critical bird conservation and education projects in the state. To find out more about the Birdathon, I spoke with Somi Gadamidi. She's the events and donor relations coordinator for the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, which sponsors the event.
The Birdathon is similar to a walkathon type fundraiser, but instead of logging miles, you're counting how many birds you see and collecting pledges based on that. So you can register on wibirdathon.org and collect donations from your friends and family there and go out birding.
Folks can bird anywhere in the state and can bird alone or as a group. Somi said that participation in the Birdathon is growing, and with it, the impact it has on conservation projects in the state.
Last year, we raised just over $122,000 for 11 different bird conservation and outreach projects, and we had 72 teams with more than 500 participants across 29 counties. We saw 274 bird species collectively. Almost all of those were record-breaking, which is amazing, and we hope to get even more people engaged this year. And we also saw 34 organizational teams, so any nonprofit, bird club, or Wisconsin Bird City is eligible to keep half of the funds their team raises for their own local bird conservation and environmental education projects.
Funds raised during the Birdathon in 2023 were used in part for grassland expansion at the Mounds View Grassland Preserve near Blue Mound. This includes 242 acres of habitat for grassland birds there, including upland sandpipers, meadowlarks, and short-eared owls, and my personal favorite, bobolinks.
We partnered with the Prairie Enthusiasts on that project, and I mentioned that one specifically because our 2024 Bird of the Year is the bobolink, which is a grassland, or resides in grassland habitat. So we've chosen that bird because we've supported it in the past by supporting grassland restoration and management initiatives through the Birdathon proceeds, and it's a species of special concern here in Wisconsin with rapidly declining grassland.
Back at the Holy Wisdom Monastery, Amy is guiding our group through the wooded trails. We move quietly, listening for birds as well as watching for them.
So let's pause here and see if we can sort out some of these layers. The advantage of birding as a group, too, is we have a lot of eyes and ears, so point things out. On the right side of one of his closest pair of trees, this is a thrush. So this is something that's related to a robin. We're hoping it's going to spin around. The best field mark, there are a couple different kinds of thrush this could be, and we want to get a good look at the front of this bird to figure out which thrush we have. Maybe it'll sing for us.
The thrush turned out to be uncooperative, neither singing nor turning around before it was on its way. We stand and listen to turkey, robins, and red-winged blackbirds. Then Amy spots a tiny, fidgeting bird.
Oh, here. This is a nice look. There's a little small bird that's moving through the treetops of the tiny leafed out. That is a kind of warbler called an American Red Start. It's flitting around. It pushed further to the left now.
This one over us.
It's a little tiny blackbird with some really bright orange patches on it. Okay, now it's all the way into the conifers.
Good. So this time of year, there are a lot of warblers moving through. This is probably just about peak warbler migration. Some of these birds will stick around and breed here. Last year, we found an American redstart nest on the property. But a lot of them move further north, too. So they're just kind of, you know, they're stopping here, staging for a night or two, and then they'll continue on north of us. But one of the reasons this is just an amazing time of year to bird is because so many things are moving through Wisconsin.
Migration is a critical time for birds, whether they are migrating south in the fall or headed home to Wisconsin and points further north in the spring. Food is crucial to their success. Enter Fat Bird Week.
Fat is fuel in the world of bird migration.
That's Shelley Torkelson. She's Communications Director with the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, quoting Ryan Brady of the Wisconsin DNR. She said, when they started working on Fat Bird Week with SOS, Save Our Songbirds, and other partners, they asked Ryan what fat means to a bird.
One example is the male ruby-throated hummingbird, which weighs, on average, just 3 grams. They actually double their body mass prior to migration.
So what's on the menu for birds?
Basically invertebrates. Think caterpillars, beetles, and flies, spiders, worms, crustaceans. Another key source of nutrients for birds are berries of native plants. So those are really important to plant in your yard, and that's one of the ways that you can help keep Wisconsin's birds fat and healthy.
Wisconsin Fat Bird Week starts this Thursday, April 19th, and is a bracket-style tournament. All of the birds are natives of Wisconsin, and they've been given their fighting bird names like Gluttonous Golden Crown Kinglet, the Hefty Horned Lark, and the Chonky Canada Warbler. From Friday, April 19th to Friday, April 26th, anyone can go online to vote for their favorite fat bird. The winner will be announced at a webinar to be held at noon on Tuesday, August 30th. Shelley says folks who attend the webinar will be among the first to hear which bird won. Back at the Holy Wisdom Monastery, our morning of birding is winding down. Amy is pretty sure the uncooperative thrush from early in our walk was a Swainson's thrush. And we saw or heard warblers, catbirds, Canadian geese, and yes, those turkeys laughing at us, among many other birds. A sharp-eyed member of our group spotted a young red-tailed hawk that we continued to see in various spots throughout the last half of our hike. The Great Wisconsin Birdathon runs from April 15th to June 15th annually. To find out more about how you can participate or to donate, visit the Natural Resources Foundation website at wisconservation.org. While you're there, vote for your favorite fat bird during Fat Bird Week and sign up for the August 30th webinar, where the Fat Bird Week winner will be announced. Reporting for WRT News, I'm Catherine Garvins.
Robin is really working hard, making sure we all learn its song.
Yes.
It's that time of year again. Southern Wisconsin is seeing another generation of baby animals. On tonight's edition of Wildlife Weekly, Jackie Sandberg tells us about some unique and unexpected patients that recently arrived at the Dane County Humane Society's Rehabilitation Center.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I get to talk about northern saw-whet owls. And yes, we have talked about them before, however, first time in my life, I've gotten the chance to work with baby saw-whet owls. Yes, it's baby season. We've probably talked about that a couple of weeks now here, but it is that time of year where we are getting so many baby animals, and one I did not expect was northern saw-whet owls. You know, honestly, I'm still flabbergasted even this morning. It's actually a really cool experience. If you don't know much about the northern saw-whet owl, they are one of the smallest owls in North America. They are incredibly cute and dainty, and I feel like you never see them in the wild because they're just so strictly nocturnal. They generally begin hunting about a half hour before actual true sunset until maybe a half an hour after sunset or sunrise has happened, but These birds are primarily hunting all through the evening hours. They're very stealthy. They are great listeners. They have amazing acuity for hearing small mammals, which is the biggest item on their prey list, like deer, mice, or voles. They have asymmetric ears to help triangulate the prey, and that means that they're listening, and because their ears are asymmetric on their heads, they're able to figure out locations in three dimensions and be able to pinpoint exactly where that mouse might be in the grass so that they can swoop down and catch it, and they are silent hunters. It is just absolutely incredible. Now, Wisconsin is a state where we see saw-whet owls year-round. However, they generally do some migration, so you will see them often go down to places like Illinois or even Iowa, sometimes Missouri, and you will even see them as far south as Texas, just pretty scarce in their non-breeding range. Now, the juvenile owls do not look anything like the adults. I think to me that was the most shocking, getting to see a couple of little nestlings in a box. Yes, there was a nest box that, yes, did need intervention. And we've been working with the landowners who had a box that was used by screech owls one year and then saw-whet owls the next. And unfortunately, something might have happened to the parents. We don't really know exactly what. There's a suggestion that maybe the parents both or one of them got taken by a resident great horned owl that might be in the area. Certainly would not be out of the ordinary for a great horned owl to predate on something like a really small northern saw-whet owl. But they did successfully have four little babies, and three of them about 5 days older than the smallest one. But since they were not being cared for and they were still in their nest box, there was a concern that the babies could potentially starve. And I mean, when you think about it, if they hadn't left their nest box and food was not being brought to them by either of the parents, and usually the male will drop off quite a bit of food, sometimes in excess, to leave in the box, it was about 2.5 days, and there was grave concern that, okay, these owls are not getting any food, and if they don't get any food, they're not going to survive, and they're not fledging outside the box. So they are actually just a really cool, very interesting type of situation, because there is a live camera that was on the nest at all times. And so, you know, it's amazing research that you can do if you know of a nest site where you can, you know, put out something technological like that and be able to really glean more information about certain species and their biology and their natural history. I think that's one use in our day and age here where technology just, sometimes it's overwhelming and we have too much of it almost, but heck, if you can use it for wildlife to watch cool animals, I'm all for it, because we get to learn a lot more in a non-invasive way. So this was what was able to help, you know, basically prove, yes, there was no parental input for 2.5 days. So in that case, we felt that intervention might be necessary. Really cool birds to see. Their bellies are like a cinnamon color, so it's like an orangish ruddy tan, and their faces are dark chocolate brown, and the little spot between their eyes is like a little Y shape, and it's bright white, and that will go away for the most part by the time that they're older. In the fall, they'll molt those feathers. The little Y shape will kind of still stay, you can see it, but they'll get the beautiful facial disc, and their breast feathers will then be more of a white and cinnamon kind of striping, or like spotted sort of pattern, more like striping on the flanks rather than spots, but they will have white spots on their wings, and so it's kind of like a brown and white kind of chocolatey color, and that's why they blend in so well, so you can't really see them super often in the trees. They also have these beautiful bright yellow eyes that are very piercing. And when I say small, I mean probably about the height of your cell phone. So yes, very small, not easy to spot, but they are all throughout Wisconsin. So they are kind of generalist. You may find them in places you would not expect. So, you know, us at Dane County Humane Society, we are excited to help these little owlets get to their final stages so that we're able to get them out, hopefully released and healthy. That would be excellent. The goal is always to get them back to their natal territory. So wish us luck, and know that, yes, we do work with a lot of different species. And sometimes, even for those of us that have been in the field a long time, you kind of get a first in a way. And it's a great learning experience, I think, for everybody involved. So that's our segment today here, talking about northern saw-whet owls on WORT. It's an exciting little owl species that we absolutely love. We've worked mostly with adults, but now we get to say we work with little fledglings too, so that's pretty exciting. So we appreciate you listening about all the different baby animals that we are getting here in the spring season. And if you need any assistance, give us a call at 608-287-3235 or visit our website at www.giveshelter.org. So that's giveshelter.org. Thanks for listening here on WORT. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was John Klein Wilson.
Your reporters were Lila Grubb and Charlie Belosky.
Special thanks to feature contributors Jackie Sandberg, Oliver Gerhards, and Catherine Garvins.
Super Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Fay Parks produced this newscast.
And Shally Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News podcast and subscribe next time you're looking for a new podcast.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Up next is Spanish language news with Anoistro Patio. Good night.